Hello and welcome to Great Lives. Listeners, I wish you could see the braces. The florid braces and the pink cord trousers of my guest this week. Attire that his chosen Great Life would in fact have adored. He is a national institution. His big and small screen credits include The Rocky Horror Picture Show, Porridge, Poldark and I, Claudius. But he's more recently been seen chewing on kangaroo testicles for an appreciative television audience who voted him king of the I'm a Celebrity jungle in 2007. Like Madonna, Beyoncé and Sting, Christopher recently opted to change his name to simply Biggins. So, the artist formerly known as Christopher, whom have you chosen as your Great Life?
Well, I think it has to be Nero. Yes, it does, without any question. And I have a great feeling for this man. And it was an honour to play him in the brilliant TV series I, Claudius.
And here is Biggins alongside Agrippina, gloating over the poisoned corpse of his adoptive father in I, Claudius.
Is he dead?
Yes. Yes, he's dead.
Then I am empty.
You are emperor. Everything I ever dreamed of has come true.
Emperor. I am emperor of Rome.
Christopher, you turned up in those final episodes of I, Claudius, playing Nero as an overgrown, petulant child, fond of food, music, sex and slightly overfond of your mother. Was it fun to play?
I tell you, it was probably the greatest role I've ever done, and I'm so proud to have done it. And you know, people come up and say, oh, congratulations on this and that, but when they mention I, Claudius, I am thrilled.
Did your casting director see then anything of yourself in the young Nero?
Well, I think Herbie Wise, who cast me in it, who was the brilliant director of the series, absolutely saw something of me, and I feel extremely comfortable in that period of Rome and being that particular man. We know that he had some extraordinary things that he did to people, but he was very, very somehow me. I really enjoyed that. And if I'd lived in Roman times, I wouldn't have wanted to be anybody else. You're looking very quizzical there, Miriam.
Yes, I'd better bring Miriam in at this point, who joins us to flesh out that monument to the pleasures of the flesh, the Emperor Nero. Dr. Miriam Griffin is Emeritus Fellow of Somerville College, Oxford, and the author of Nero, The End of a Dynasty. Miriam, besides poor King John, is any man in history more victim of a bad press than Nero? The name's a byword for cruelty, and we'll get, I hope, to the real character of Nero later on. But how did he land this bad reputation? Was he the worst of the worst?
I have to say that probably Caligula has a worse press, but he didn't last so long, so it wasn't so important. I mean, people have always had things they wanted to say on the other side about Nero, partly because of the literature of the period and because of the remains of his architecture. But essentially, the tradition as we have it is often negative. There were apparently positive accounts. We haven't got them. They were either contemporary and therefore riddled with flattery, or they were Greek, because he was very, very popular in the Greek East. But most of the tradition we have was developed under the Flavian dynasty, the next dynasty. And the fact that it was a different dynasty, which had to justify the fact that it had replaced the founding dynasty, is partly responsible for the press he has. There's nobody who wanted to speak up for him.
I mean, the elephant in the room, let's not beat about the bush, is the fire, him starting the fire. Was that true?
Historians think it was not true. You can't prove it, but there are several reasons why not. For one thing, the moon was nearly full, so you couldn't have chosen a worse time to have people going around with torches because they could clearly be seen. For another thing, it destroyed a lot of the palace, the Domus Transitoria, the earlier palace, which he was already building, which he clearly was not fed up with, because a lot of the paintings were rescued and used for the new one. So it's very unlikely, I think, that he started it himself.
In the episode that I did, there was a wonderful scene where he burns his mother and he start burning all Claudius's papers. And of course, there was a real wonderful sight of me absolutely relishing the flames, you know. Well, we didn't actually go into the fact, but I've read, though, you're absolutely right, that it probably wasn't true that he did burn.
No, he was at Antium, in fact, and he came up at the time. I mean, the story about fiddling, of course, probably has its basis in the fact that he did write an epic poem about the fall of Troy. And it, no doubt, had plenty of flames in it. And he used to rehearse this on a stage in the palace, where Tacitus, the best historian we have, says he actually did this performance during the fire. But some of the other historians want him outside in full view of the crowd, naturally. And we can't prove it didn't happen, but I think he was rather busy with the rescue operation.
Did you swat up on the real Nero before you played the imaginary
one? Well, when I was offered the role, I immediately went and got the book, which I hadn't read, and I went to a Greek island for a holiday, and I read it, and I was so excited by the prospect of it all. And then the script arrived, and what happened was we went into the rehearsal period, which was very short, funnily enough. I think it was like 10 days or something, and record on the 11th. But we did have a man come and tell us about the period. And someone asked him the question about what was the servant situation. He said, well, servants in those days, you just think now of machines. I mean, there would be someone to wake him up, someone to get him out of bed, someone to put his slippers on, someone to take his robe off, someone to put another robe on, someone to run the bath, someone to dry him. I mean, and he had all these people. And that's, I think, what appeals to me more than anything.
How unlike the home life of our own dear Biggins.
I know, but I have a fantasy that that's how I would love to live, with hundreds of people looking after me.
Did you feel that you knew the man?
Honestly, I really, really did. There's so many things that happen in that particular episode. Like, for instance, there's the scene, as you mentioned earlier, where Barbara Young comes to me because I'm very frustrated that my wife won't have sex with me. And so she says, don't worry, darling, there's plenty of other things. And she takes my hand on her leg, and then towards the end of the scene she lies back and I go on top of her. Now, when that was shown in America, they cut that scene because they said they couldn't take incest, which is bizarre.
The sex was all right, but
the sex was all right, but the incest, that was what they couldn't take.
Where's Octavia?
She's locked herself in her bedroom. She won't let me in.
Did you quarrel?
Yes.
Well, why can't you sleep alone?
I don't feel like it. I feel...
Oh, I don't know.
She won't lock me out when I'm emperor. She won't tell me what to do. No one will. I shall do as I please.
It was very naughty of Octavia to lock you out. Very naughty. But she's only a child. She doesn't understand how you feel.
Let's get back to Nero's origins, Miriam. How did he get the job? Where did he come from? What was his background?
He's a direct descendant of the original emperor. That is Augustus. This is a system which took over from the Roman Republic after a terrible battery of civil wars. And he is a direct descendant through his mother, Agrippina. But he might not have succeeded if she had not managed to marry the incumbent Emperor Claudius, who was very susceptible to women, the only completely heterosexual Roman emperor, incidentally.
Really?
And Claudius really liked women, and she knew how to deal with him.
Almost disgraceful, isn't it?
Yes.
And the result of this was that she got him to adopt a son who was older than his own natural son, so that when Claudius died, or shall we say, was eased out of this world, Nero was in the right position to take over. It had been a very bad childhood. I think he was probably quite neurotic. His mother had been sent into exile when he was very young, and then his father died, and then he was brought up by his aunt for about a year in the hands of a dancer and a barber, we're told. I've never been able to make much sense of that, but that's what the biographer says.
A fractured upbringing.
A fractured upbringing. And then his mother returned, and she had a tremendous hold over him. I mean, she was constantly telling him that he would not be emperor were it not for her machinations, which is true. And when she began to lose control of him, she would threaten him with other people who would like to be emperor and whom other people might prefer. So she was very manipulative, very clever, and he found her very difficult to stand up to. The scene that you were mentioning, of course, is in The Historians, where I have to say our best historian does what they always do when they want to string out some really lascivious story. They say there is a conflict in the sources. Some people say that it was Agrippina who was trying to seduce Nero, but other people say that it was Nero who was trying to seduce Agrippina. In this way, you get, you know, three chapters of it instead of one.
Did he have any rivals, his mum, his bossy mum, having put him on the throne, so to speak?
He had a lot of rivals, because this is a very strange political system in which it is not an overt monarchy, and therefore there is no law of succession. And you are supposed to be, in a way, qualified for the job. The original emperor had had the traditional republican career, and he had been successful in war. Nero, of course, was only 17. And he had done absolutely nothing. And there were people around who were just as closely descended from the Emperor Augustus as he was. And, of course, he was the fourth in the dynasty. And so by the time you got to him, the numbers of people who had that kind of blood relationship had proliferated. So I think that was part of his problem. I think he was extremely anxious throughout his reign to justify his position.
Do you think, Christopher and Miriam, do you know that Nero made any serious attempt to be a good emperor? That he'd been plonked so young on the throne. Do you think he wanted to be a good emperor? Do you think he tried?
Personally, I mean, I feel that he did. And I think he did a lot of things, like, for instance, the buildings. Then he wanted to create a wonderful Rome, somewhere that was very special. And I think he did try. And I think he got waylaid. And I think that was all to do with his mother and her liaisons with other people and the jealousy of other people. But I always believe that he did want to do a good job.
Waylaid. It would make a marvellous title for his autobiography.
Yeah, waylaid.
It? Waylaid. Was he waylaid, Miriam?
I think he desperately wanted to be popular.
Yes.
And he wanted to succeed. And initially, actually, in a way, his mother helped, because she was such a bully that he was willing to listen to the advice of other people who were rather gentler with him. And that was the philosopher Seneca, who was his tutor, and the commander of the Praetorian Guard, Afranius Burrus. And these two were prepared to indulge him in return for his learning the art of government. And then other people came on the scene when his mother died and said, why are you listening to these people? You can do what you like. You have absolute power. They tell you you can't perform as a charioteer, but you can do whatever you like. And so he moved over into another vein in which he tried to be popular by a kind of exhibitionism, and he tried to soothe his fears by repression.
Give us a word picture of the young 18-year-old. Biggins here has formed our impression of Nero. Was he like that? What was he likable? Was he attractive?
I think that... No, I think Biggins represented him very well. He was handsome, reasonably tall, and quite nicely shaped. He's supposed to have had body odour, but that doesn't show on television. Yeah. And I think he appealed to people very much because Claudius, who preceded him, though he had rather a handsome head, didn't move well, and also was rather elderly. And so the young, handsome Nero came on the stage, and they were very impressed with him, I think. And he had his own idea. We were talking before about whether he wanted to be a good emperor. I mean, part of the problem was he had his own conception, I think. He was prepared to play by the rules, politically, as they said, but what he really wanted to do was to change the tastes in Rome. He wanted his elite to like music and athletics in the Greek fashion. He didn't like gladiatorial games very much. He had to put them on. Mm. But that was not what he was interested in. And he didn't think there was anything wrong with performing. He had schools in which they were trained so that they would do it properly. He had a gymnasium where they did nude athletics in the Greek fashion, which the Romans disapproved of. But it was part of the job of the emperor to set the tone for society, and I think he tried to do that. And if he had perhaps moved more gradually, he might have succeeded, but he tried to do it all at once, and it got mixed up in their minds with his own personal performance.
He even invents his own Olympic Games, the Neronia. I hesitate to speculate as to the events in the Neronia. What was it?
Well, the Neronia was actually musical competitions, yes. A lot of it. And also, he always liked chariot racing. And he said, this is the thing that the great heroes of the past did. And, of course, if you read Homer, I mean, Achilles was perfectly good at strumming the lyre and singing.
But eyebrows were raised when he wanted to perform himself in his own...
It's performing
event.
Himself,
yes.
Which I think people weren't sure of.
Quite.
The soldiers didn't like it.
As if Gordon thing. Brown wanted a special event to you know, in the Olympics or something.
Yes, exactly,
like that.
Yes.
We have to realise that he's in costume.
Yes.
And very often, you know, some of his parts were female parts and so on, and they thought this was... I mean, there's one wonderful incident where one of the Praetorian Guard says, the Emperor's giving birth.
I must come back to your thing about, which I found fascinating, that he had terrible BO. And I only say that because when we did the series, I had... and I think we filmed over 3 days. Every day in my hair was put these amazing fresh flowers. And they smelt so amazing. And I also had a nosegay as well. I can almost smell it now. And you're probably right, you know. He did have the body odour. That suddenly occurred to me then. And also, I was dressed from head to toe. All my undergarments and my undergarments were pure silk. I mean, I'm fascinated to see that he liked doing lady impersonations because I pantomime Dame. But I always say it starts from the shoes, you know, put the right shoes on. And that certainly was with Nero. Everything that I wore was handmade for me and was I just felt so comfortable.
You mentioned the pantomime. He was very suspicious of actors. And didn't he ban pantomimes? I believe that he did.
Did he? Really?
Yes, he expelled the actors for a period of time, about 5 years. This is always happening in Rome, because the problem is the fans. It's really football hooligans is the problem.
Mm. Yeah.
They get tremendously excited,
yeah.
And they have their favourite actors.
Do you find this at your pantomime?
All the time. Yeah.
And you have to remember, the pantomime is different. The real pantomime star doesn't utter a sound. It's complete mime.
Mime, absolutely.
But what happened, I think, when he expelled them was that Nero took to going to the theatre. He loved the theatre. Mm. And sometimes they could see him, and sometimes he hid. And it somehow produced an enormous excitement. And so they began to have all these sort of riots, and he had to get rid of them.
Did he relish killing people? Because, of course, his uncle Caligula was famous for that, wasn't he? He was always doing the most appalling things to people.
I think Caligula was, by nature, much crueler than
yes.
Nero, actually. Nero, I think, mostly got into it through fear. And then some of the stories about it are sexual. I suppose the persecution of the Christians, where he made the punishment fit the crime by burning them as living tortures. I mean, that is rather horrible.
For which the Christians have never really forgiven him, and that may be some of the explanation for his awful reputation through history.
Yes, because in addition, he has a very bad press with the Jews, because the great Jewish revolt took place under Nero because of the rapacity of his governors, and the Christians.
Mm. Was popularity enough to make you as an emperor? What went wrong for Nero? Was it that crowd-pleasing was all he could do?
I think what went wrong is that he got across the governing class of Rome, partly because he was paranoid and began to persecute some of them and put them to death, which they didn't take to. Also, he was expensive, especially after the fire and the rebuilding of Rome. He devalues the currency and begins really widespread confiscations. So that was not enormously popular, I think. I think he was unlucky in that. And then also, he panicked. because he didn't have the fundamental quality you really needed to feel secure as emperor, and that is to be a soldier.
Yes.
And he had none of that. He was planning a campaign at the end of his life. I think myself that he could have saved himself if he had actually appeared personally to the Praetorian Guard, but he didn't do that.
This is what Tacitus tells us of Nero's progress once he's got rid of his rival Britannicus.
Other murders were meant to follow, but the emperor's tutors, Sextus Afranius Burrus and Lucius Aeneas Seneca, prevented them. They collaborated in controlling the emperor's perilous adolescence. Their policy was to direct his deviations from virtue into licensed channels of indulgence. Agrippina's violence, inflamed by all the passions of ill-gotten tyranny, encountered their united opposition.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest this week, Biggins, formerly known as Christopher, has chosen Nero as his hero. Separating the fact from the fiction is Dr. Miriam Griffin of Somerville College, Oxford. When did things start to go really badly wrong? Was it with the death of his mother?
I think it was. There was this love-hate relationship he had with his mother, and I think it was far too much for him to bear when she died, because then he really was left alone, because, you know, she did deal with so much of his life.
Of course, he saw to it that she died. I don't think anybody doubts that he actually did away with her, because he got tired of being bullied and nagged.
Also, it was a petulant thing that he did, and getting, you know, he probably had a bad moment with her and thought, well, that's it, get rid of her. She'd said something to him, and you think, well, I'm the emperor, I can kill her, or have her killed, you know.
Well, part of it was that there's an incident about clothing. Nero was going through the royal robes. It's interesting that you were talking about the silk robes. He loved clothing loved wearing flowery silk robes. Anyway, he was going through the wardrobe of the palace, and he found some wonderful things, and he sent them to Agrippina, and she said to him, oh, so you think I don't have a claim on the rest?
So now, with her out of the way, he can indulge his artistic tendencies, if that's what they're called, to the full. He sings, he plays the lyre, races chariots. He's not really being the sort of stoic Roman that he ought to be, much more of an effeminate Greek. Miriam, what was he trying to do with this obsession for performance? Didn't he realise that people didn't like it? Didn't he see that it was coming across badly?
Well, he was advised against performing in public, and actually he was very good about that. I mean, initially we're told he was performing on a sort of private stage and even a private circus. I mean, people gathered to watch him, but he was not performing in public. And the first really public performance was at Naples, which was a kind of Greek city, where people dressed in Greek dress and where everybody went to relax and have a rather louche holiday. So that was rather different. And it wasn't actually until the second Neronia when he actually performed himself. So I think he did realize that there was a problem. But he also wanted to set an example. That was the thing. He really thought that these tastes he had were good tastes, and that it would be good for the Roman aristocracy to be interested in these things rather than gladiatorial games. But he moved so fast that he offended people, and a lot of them just thought this is exhibitionism.
It's my experience watching senior politicians that even in the 21st century, try as they may and know as they do that it's important not to get, as we say in the press, arrogant and out of touch, simply being a prime minister or a leader of the opposition begins to isolate you from people. You can't travel on the underground or in buses easily any longer. And frighteningly quickly, and I think to an extent that the public don't quite understand, it becomes almost impossible to know what people are thinking or feeling or saying. Must have been even more so for Nero.
Well, you could say that his roaming the streets of Rome in disguise, as he did in the early days, was partly that. He liked hearing what people said about the emperor. The trouble was that if he got into trouble and got into a sort of scuffle with somebody, then he tended to reveal his identity. And this wasn't really fair.
Yes. Hang on, it's me.
But I think he did want to know what people thought, and he knew that a lot of the aristocrats actually liked going on the stage. And we know this because there was legislation to keep them off it. You don't need to legislate if people don't want to go on.
You mention him creeping around at night in disguise. But the stories go further than that. They suggest that he was murdering people, throwing their bodies down the sewers, forcing respectable married women to pretend to be brothel keepers and invite him in, ordering one boy to be castrated and then going through a marriage ceremony with him. How much of this is fact? How much fiction? You know, he's not sounding like just a frustrated poet and performer here.
Well, it depends what part of the reign you're looking at. I mean, the events about Sporus, the boy he had castrated, of course, is quite late on, and this is after the death of his wife, Papaya. It's a rather pathetic story, actually. This boy apparently resembled his wife, and he used her as his wife. At the same time as he was being the female to another one of his ex-slaves, we're told. So it's all very complicated, but those things are really quite late when already things are going down the drain, I think.
So did he do a lot of homosexual acts during his reign?
Most emperors and a lot of Roman males are bisexual. What they disapproved of was not homosexuality, it was being the passive partner.
Mm.
So that, in a way,
they disapproved of that.
They disapproved of that. So the relationship with Sporus, the eunuch, is okay. It's the other one.
Yes.
That they don't like.
Yeah.
Where he's actually pretends to be a bride and cries that he's being deflowered, that kind of thing.
How did the end come? How did he die?
Well, he fled Rome, and he went to the villa of one of his ex-slaves and was hiding. And then they could hear the horsemen approaching, because by that time the Praetorian Guard had declared for the governor of Spain and the Senate had declared him a public enemy. And they said to him, you've got to kill yourself. And he found it very difficult to do, but one of his ex-slaves helped him, so he actually stabbed himself in the throat and died. But he was so concerned that he should not be mutilated. This aesthetic sense, right to the end. He was gathering bits of marble and said, you know, you must give me a nice burial and please make sure they don't cut off my head.
A final question. We've been talking about someone who is obviously a man of great sensitivity in many ways, big ideas, and a party animal too, just a playboy who never grew up. But fate cut Nero too much slack. Do you think becoming emperor was the worst thing that ever happened to him?
Oh, no, not at all. I think he loved it. In my mind, anyway, it was the final accolade. It was something that he'd subconsciously was working towards. And when it came, he loved it, he took it, and he used it to the full.
My thanks to Miriam Griffin and Biggins. And as Nero lived a life of performance and artifice, perhaps we should end with fiction rather than fact. Here is Christopher Biggins as the young Nero setting fire to his adoptive father's memoirs in I, Claudius and enjoying an early pyromaniacal thrill. Goodbye.
What a pretty thing a fire is.